From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today the campaign trail took to Twitter. Tweets before dawn from Donald Trump, mostly about a former Miss Universe winner who came up in the debate on Monday.
He called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her? Her name is Alicia Machado.
Where did you find her?
And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good. Let me just tell you.
I think it's time for our weekly roundtable.
Here and now.
2016.
And joining us today, Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Rebecca Sinderbrand is managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
And I want to just talk about that, the tweet thing, the Alicia Machado issue right now first before we get on to other things, because there are polls out today that we should talk about and how this race has changed since the debate. But so if you look at the tweets that started coming out very early this morning from Donald Trump, he called Alicia Machado disgusting. And without citing any evidence that one exists, he referenced a sex tape. Here he is on Fox News Wednesday night talking about Machado's weight gain when she became Miss Universe when Trump owned that pageant.
She had a lot of difficulties, and, you know, they wanted to fire her. The company itself wanted to fire her. I saved her job. I'll bet you if you put up and added up all the time I spoke to her, it was probably less than 5 minutes. I mean, I wasn't...
Rebecca, a lot of political analysts just throwing their hands up in the air going, what is he doing? This is not helping him with suburban women who he needs to win the election.
I mean, really, you have to wonder what we're seeing this week and what we're seeing today is basically an extension of the debate stage where Hillary Clinton set the agenda and Donald Trump just kind of followed her messaging. You know, if you had said on Monday, it's as though Hillary Clinton said, let's talk about Alicia Machado all week. And Donald Trump said, great, let's do it. And that's exactly what the Clinton campaign wanted. And that's exactly what we've done. It's hard to see how this benefits Donald Trump in any possible way, particularly at this moment. We're less than 40 days from the election.
Isn't that amazing?
And we're talking about the Republican nominee is tweeting about a sex tape.
Well, Enrique Acevedo, the Democratic nominee is tweeting in Spanish. How does this affect Donald Trump and Latinos?
Well, I mean, she's, put out a very robust Spanish language operation trying to reach out to the Latino vote. She has commercials in Spanish. She has a large operation in swing states where the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, will decide the election, like Florida, for example. So,
well, and I'm more referring to the fact that Clinton is responding to Trump today in Spanish about Machado. How does Donald Trump's dissing of not just a woman but a Latina affect him?
I think the Alicia Machado story helps Hillary Clinton with two key demographics, and you just mentioned that. Women and Latinos, and especially Latino women, who are the ones that are going to energize the family to go out and vote, to register and to participate in the election in November.
Yeah. What about when you look more broadly at the post-debate landscape, how it's changed? We've got a new poll out from WBUR of New Hampshire today that shows Clinton 7 points ahead of Trump. A Detroit News poll in Michigan shows the same margin in Florida. She's seeing a 2-point shift in her favor. Rebecca, how has the race changed since the debate?
You know, Clinton's getting a bump, obviously, at exactly the right time. Debate bumps can't necessarily last as long as people who get them would like them to last. But the interesting thing is coming at this precise moment, they're already voting in half a dozen states. Early voting has already begun. So election day, in a certain sense, is already here, and it's just going to keep going and gaining momentum in the next week or two. By the middle of next month, more than half the states are going to be voting. The votes that are banked now count the same as the ones that are cast on election day. So if at this moment, even if the debate bump doesn't last, the votes that are cast as this debate bump is happening will definitely give Clinton a cushion.
Well, I want to ask both of you about Donald Trump's threats to bring up Bill Clinton's past infidelities and in threatening, you know, saying he's not bringing them up, he's bringing them up. Let's listen to some of his thoughts on that.
For 90 minutes, I watched her very carefully. And I was also holding back. I didn't want to do anything to embarrass her.
Enrique, he said this over and over again since that rally. that he isn't saying anything about Bill Clinton. Of course, in that he is saying something about Bill Clinton. What does this do with the audiences, the voters he needs to get?
I think this is, you know, part of what Donald Trump does so well. Sometimes he's not explicit about the things he wants to say, but just by suggesting them, he puts it, you know, he puts it out there, and then the rumors start and the conversation around these issues start and gain momentum. But I don't think this will help him in the long term, because it doesn't answer the most important question that Trump needs to answer to voters. Does he has the temperament to lead the country in times of unprecedented polarization and in the face of major security and environmental crisis? If he does this, I think he's answering the question in the wrong way.
Well, and as he asked that question, just 1 second, I'm going to come to you, Rebecca. But as he asked that question, as voters asked that question about him, whether he has the temperament, I feel like there is very little discussion about the possibility of the first female president and the inherent bias against her by a lot of voters because she is a woman. Rebecca, listen to this, because Mara Liasson today on NPR had a montage of what Trump's running mate Mike Pence has been saying.
Donald Trump is a man with broad shoulders.
To see that broad-shouldered, clear-eyed, strong leadership.
Who never backs down, who has a heart and a mind and the broad shoulders to make.
Are there a lot of people, do you think, who are specifically voting against Hillary Clinton or will because she's a woman and we're not talking about it?
You know, it's one of those questions that to some extent may be very difficult to answer because people may not even be aware of what's motivating their particular vote. You know, there are a lot of assumptions that people gain throughout their lives that they aren't aware that these are assumptions that are guiding their vote, mm-hmm. and they assume that their vote is powered by logic completely, but there's a bit of emotion in it. That can't necessarily be factored for. I think just kind of circling back to the Lewinsky attack, which does play into that, you know, the idea that attacking a woman based on her husband's infidelities is something that would have any sort of political advantage is kind of a questionable attack. And you even have Newt Gingrich saying, telling Sean Hannity, telling Donald Trump publicly, hey, this may not be the best idea. Maybe you want to back off of this one.
Well, either she has to get, you know, shoulder pads or something. Or as, you know, Paul Krugman wrote a really provocative column today in The New York Times pointing out just what you said, Jeremy, that it's the press, in fact, in particular, that's held Hillary Clinton to a higher standard, forgiven Donald Trump, especially early on, his gaffes. Everybody made a lot about how she prepared. You know, that's, you know, women, a lot of women related to that. She worked harder to prepare for the debate than her male running mate did. So people are kind of pointing to that. But Enrique, I want to ask you something else, because Paul Krugman brought up another thought. He said, you know, another thing that maybe this election is pointing out to us is that there are more supremacists, white supremacists in this country that Americans want to pay attention to.
That's an interesting point. I think this election has revealed the worst and the best of what we are and who we are as a society. And we have to recognize that in you know, our most negative version, there are forces like American white supremacists and people who are racist, and racial tension is still a reality in this country. So I think it's a valid point, and it's important that we talk about this. And going back to what Rebecca said, because this is so interesting, emotion over logic. You don't only see that in women as a segment of the electorate, the most important segment, but you also see that in the Latino vote. Look at Cuban Americans in Florida, the only segment of the Latino vote supporting Donald Trump. He allegedly did businesses with Cuba under the embargo, which would be a deal breaker for any other candidate.
That's being reported, yep. Mm-hmm.
That's been reported, exactly. And he's also censored the press at some point, some media outlets. He's criticized or tried to negatively talk about the election or the possible election outcome. And these are people who, on their logic, should be against Donald Trump. But their emotions are leading them to support Trump.
Well, we cannot go through this week of political news without playing this piece of tape from Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, with Chris Matthews on MSNBC, and he was asked to name a foreign leader he admired.
Anybody in the world you like, anybody, pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
Which one?
I'm having a brain. I'm
well, name
a brain
anybody.
Fox. Fox.
Rebecca, your thoughts on whether this matters, because Gary Johnson is collecting in some states a double digit percentage.
It's pretty amazing, to be perfectly honest. Remember, this is a man who came just short of making it onto the debate stage. And yet, over the past few weeks, he's had a series of moments that, you know, we were having a conversation in the newsroom the other day. It's as though he'd taken a large bet against himself in this election. He's essentially kind of almost writing it off. No. And so it's interesting to see how that's collapsed.
Thousands of listeners were yelling, Merkel, Hollande, you're trying to help him there. That's Rebecca Sinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, helping us with this week's campaign 2016 roundup. As you said, Rebecca, 40 days. It's amazing. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The UN says the U.S. owes African Americans reparations. That's the headline of a task force report this week, laying out America's history, from slavery to oppressive Jim Crow laws to the redlining in the 50s and 60s that kept blacks from investing in homes and businesses and passing them on, to black kids getting arrested in school for what white kids would get scolded for. The report says to understand problems like excessive police force today, you have to talk about that history. Ricardo Sunga chairs the UN Working Group, which authored the report. He's in Geneva by Skype. Ricardo, welcome.
Well, I'm very happy to be here to discuss these matters with you.
Yeah, thank you. And just how did this all come about? We know that this was at the invitation of the United States. African Americans across the country spoke with you. But what about United States headlines or news told you that there was something to explore here?
Well, the United States is not an exception to racial discrimination. We're just very happy that the United States issued that official invitation. Because for us to carry out a country visit, it is a requirement that the country first invite us officially. And when we received the invitation, we were very glad that the country mission last January pushed through.
Well, so you were invited by the U.S. You spent 10 days in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Jackson, Mississippi, Chicago, Illinois, New York City. Look, we know police shootings of African-American men have been in the headlines. What did you hear from African-Americans that you spoke with?
The procedure we went through, the process, was one in which we heard testimonies from civil society organizations, from victims, from family members of those who were the subject of violence. And we are very saddened by what we heard, the testimonies about police violence and killings, and about the problem of impunity, about those responsible not being held to account. And we see the need for these killings certainly to be addressed. And part of that is looking at what happened beforehand, because only then can we better understand what the cause are now, the cause for reparatory justice, the calls for greater compliance with international standards, for example, with the UN basic principles on the use of force and firearms by law enforcement officials. And in light of recent developments, also the need for the state to ensure that the authorities protect the rights of protesters for freedom of assembly and association.
Look, you heard from people about profiling, about excessive control, and reports from the Department of Justice on the Ferguson Police Department. That was in 2015, confirmed those practices. There was a report from the Police Accountability Task Force in Chicago. It concluded that racism was one of the main factors that explained, you know, arrests without justification, detentions without legal counsel. In 2014, the city of New York withdrew its appeal of a case questioning stop and frisk. Stop and frisk acknowledged as something that was disproportionately used against African Americans. So there has been reaction in the United States to some of the things that you heard.
Yes, there is a reaction. But we urge that there be a continuing constructive dialogue. And they must go to the extent of exploring further the subject of reparatory justice, because everything is interconnected. There are civil and political rights issues. There are economic, social, and cultural rights issues in education, issues in housing, issues in food. There's a need for a public acknowledgement of past historical injustices there's a need thus for a conversation on reparatory justice.
Well, let's talk more about that. Reparations, reparatory justice. In South Africa, it was peace and reconciliation. It was people able to address each other. But a lot of what you're talking about is in the very far past. How do you see reparatory justice working in the United States?
It must not be understood in a narrow sense. Reparations, as it relates to justice, is not limited to compensation. Rather, it covers also restitution and satisfaction. Restitution means making right what was wrong. And satisfaction, that includes public acknowledgement, formal apology, guarantees of non-repetition. There is no one particular formula for it. It's certainly something that should not be placed under a cover. There can be no doing so forever. It's essential to ease the racial tensions now that there be a discussion on reparations, on reparatory justice.
Ricardo Sunga, he chaired the UN report on racial violence in the U.S. It concluded Americans should go back to slavery to understand today's tensions. But it also points out not all American textbooks even teach slavery. Let's bring in Noliwe Rooks, professor of Africana Studies and interim department chair at Cornell. Noliwe, what was your reaction to this report?
Well, you know, I think that it is amazing to have a world body actually make the argument that we hear most often in social media, quite frankly. The dots that report connects, young people have been connecting on Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook for some time. I would also have to point out that it is something a little unsettling that it comes from a body that the United States government does not, in fact, have to pay much attention to. When we get to the conversation about, but what next? How do we have redress? How do we have healing? How do we move forward? I don't think we know how to do that.
We'll talk about that, because Ricardo Sunga talked about reparations, but he told us not necessarily financially. He said that's up to the United States, but definitely repairs. Mm-hmm. And also, there would be some financial repair in his mind. For instance, the forgiving of debts, in the criminalization of poverty, which the Justice Report showed in Ferguson, blacks disproportionately arrested and then jailed because they couldn't pay the fees
right.
that went with the arrest, and it was more about raising revenue than security. Do you think, mm-hmm. for instance, those debts should be forgiven?
Well, here's the thing I always say about that report. Again, that report was a great day for social justice activists. It really confirmed what people on the ground in Ferguson and in areas surrounding it had been saying. The folks that are in Ferguson now do consistently want to point out that while they negotiated a relationship with Ferguson so that they've begun to dismantle some of the toxic policing and the collecting of fees, all of the communities bordering Ferguson have the exact same system in place. And because they were not specifically under investigation by the Justice Department, they have not, in fact, stopped themselves. So I do think that just saying basic things like, this is illegal. That just doesn't seem like that large a reach to me. And yet we have not seen that.
Well, what about the larger picture? I should ask you. Full reparations for descendants mm-hmm. of African slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that workable?
There's so many facets to it. Some of the facets are, as you pointed out in the report, people saying, so increase home ownership for African Americans, because that's a direct result of some of the policies that came out of different points in American
sure.
history.
Redlining and African Americans are unable to get loans, unable
yes.
to buy homes.
Yes, or unequal school systems that disproportionately negatively impact poor people of color. So people have said, well, why don't we equalize those school systems? That would be a form of reparations. There's some people who say have free health care because of the stresses of poverty and racism that are pretty well documented, but there's hasn't yet been any specific claim and or policy that we have seen people coalesce around. In the Caribbean, we have the Caribbean countries who have come together and are have approached Britain about some form of reparations and have been pretty well rebuffed So we do not yet have a global conversation about what that would look like. And I think in some ways that's where it really does have to start.
Well, as you say, it could start there, but it might stall there for a while. What about little things? And it's not a little thing. If, for instance, you're an African-American child in South Carolina, there's a misdemeanor law in which school disturbance constitutes a misdemeanor in South Carolina. There are police officers, and this is part of the school-to-prison pipeline. The UN group suggests that all misdemeanor laws affecting school children be repealed.
Yeah, there's all manner of remedies that the report points to, very specific cases given the places that they went. The issue is that what those changes would have to be made community by community, state by state, almost like the Ferguson example. Mm-hmm. Pointing out what happened in Ferguson did not impact any of the cities touching it. The same would be true in South Carolina or in Mississippi or in any of the cities where they offer specific examples of why we need change.
Yeah.
You would have to get people on the ground to believe that change was necessary. It's not, for the most part, it's not a federal issue. For the most part, those are not things right now that the federal government could come in and say we want change.
Well, the one thing the federal government could do, and we'll leave you with this, what about a formal presidential apology or maybe congressional apology? Has there ever been a formal apology for slavery?
No, and Representative John Conyers has been trying for decades to at least get a conversation that may lead to an apology, like some sort of federal acknowledgement that we at the very least need to talk about. There was a wrong done. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know where it starts. I don't know who in the government feels strongly about it. We have members of the international community at the UN who feel strongly about this. It remains to be seen in our own government, in our own backyard, where that same kind of passion lies.
That's Noliwe Rooks, professor and interim department chair of Africana Studies at Cornell University. Noliwe, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And the UN report, by the way, also noted the number of attacks on black transgender women, the lack of good food in poor black neighborhoods. You can read the whole report at hereandnow.org, where your thoughts on reparations are welcome.
Today, the universe has one less spacecraft. The European Space Agency's Rosetta probe crash-landed onto a comet this morning. It spent 2 years orbiting Comet 67P after spending a decade traveling through space to catch up with it. And by the way, the crash was by design, so don't feel too bad about it. NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce joins us with the details. Hi, Nell.
Hey.
And why did Rosetta make this death dive? What did scientists hope to learn?
Well, the idea is that by going from sort of in orbit around the comet to going all the way down to the surface, taking data and sending it back to Earth in real time, scientists could get a real picture of the environment around the comet, you know, what sort of dusts and gases were coming out of it. And this is the kind of data they could only get by actually sending the spacecraft down there.
And why wouldn't they want to just extend its life and let it continue to gather data orbiting around the comet?
Well, you know, all good things come to an end. The comet is actually heading away from the sun, so it's getting harder and harder to use the spacecraft's solar panels to get power. Also, this spacecraft is getting old. You know, the mission's been going on now for like 12 years. And also, comets are dusty places, so the spacecraft has been orbiting in a sort of dusty region, and dust isn't so good for spacecraft. So I think the European Space Agency just felt like this is a good time to end it.
So was the mission considered a success?
This mission is considered a historic success. This was the first mission to ever orbit a comet. There were other missions to comets that just sort of flew by and gave researchers hours or days. But this one actually traveled along with the comet for 2 years, letting scientists do an in-depth study. It also did something else that was a historic first. It deployed a lander. It deployed another small spacecraft called Philae that traveled down to the surface of the comet and touched down and gave them images right from the surface and took other readings. That was a little tricky because the landing didn't happen just like they hoped. You know, the lander bounced a couple times and ended up in kind of a shadow, so its solar panels couldn't recharge the batteries, and it didn't last as long as people wanted it to on the surface. But still, you know, no one had ever done that before, and they did get some science back. So I think most people would consider it a tremendous success.
Well, what was so interesting about this comet that the European Space Agency wanted to go to all this trouble, spend more than a decade, and then crash the thing into the comet in the end?
Well, people think of comets as being sort of ice balls, but they're much more than that. They're leftovers from when our solar system formed. So they've been sort of unchanged for 4.5 billion years. And the thinking is by studying these comets, we get clues about the origins of our solar system, which is really, you know, the origins of us.
So what has Rosetta taught scientists about comets?
A lot. I mean, everything from when they first got good pictures of this comet, everyone describes it as looking like a rubber duck. There's sort of a big body part and a big head part of it. Hmm. And that was kind of unexpected. They also learned about how things stream off the comet. They used to think there were small active regions, but now they see that it really the whole surface is active. But they got so much data that really scientists are going to be analyzing this for years, if not decades to come. So even though the mission is over, the science is still going to be going on.
And just briefly, was NASA involved in this at all?
They did. They contributed a few instruments, and also there were some NASA scientists working on the mission, along with the European Space Agency.
That's NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce talking with us about Rosetta, the Rosetta probe, which crash-landed onto a comet this morning after more than a decade in space. Nell, thank you.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court starts its new term on Monday, and since Congress still hasn't moved to hold hearings or vote on President Obama's nominee for the court, Merrick Garland, a second term with just 8 justices is about to begin. For more now on the coming term, the great NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us from Washington. Hi, Nina.
Thank you for the accolade.
Well, of course. And thank you for being here. And another term begins without a ninth justice. Are we already seeing that absence impact the term, even though it hasn't even started yet?
Well, we certainly are. There are fewer cases. We can discuss that in a minute. But if you want to look at what the next term is going to be like, you look at what the last term was like, or most of the last term. And that is, there were a record number of tie votes, 4. And that means that the lower court decision stands for the moment, but sets no national precedent. And many cases were decided on the narrowest of grounds. And Justice Elena Kagan recently said in an appearance at Harvard that what that meant was that the court was deciding virtually nothing in these cases, that they sliced the salami so thin so that they could finally compromise and agree on something, that they weren't deciding the question that they had initially taken the case to decide. And she said, you know, in the long run, that's really not good. That's not what they're there to do. They're there to resolve conflicts in the lower courts so that there are national rules that govern how we run our country legally.
Fair to say, though, that the 4-4 ties have, for the most part, so far benefited the liberal wing of the court.
No, that's actually not true. The 4-4 ties last term, 2 of them benefited the liberal wing, 2 of them benefited the conservative wing. So the immigration 4-4 tie essentially killed off the Obama immigration plan to shield the parents of children who are American citizens when the parents are deportable and to prevent the parents from being deported. So that's dead in its tracks until a later time, and when the next president either revives it, uses it, tests it, whatever, gets rid of it. But that was definitely a loss for the liberal wing of the court.
So the justices yesterday took on 8 new cases for the coming term, bringing the total number so far to 31. How does that compare to past years?
As you said, 31 so far this term. Typically, the court hears about 80 cases a term, and even that number is about half of what it was when I first started covering the court in the dark ages. But so far, as I said, 31. Last year, it was 43 at this time. Hmm. So I asked my intern, because I'm incapable of this, to calculate for me what the percentage fewer cases is. And she tells me 28%, so don't hold me to it. But
well, and none of the cases seem to be particularly divisive, though, right? No real hot-button issues in the coming term?
Well, there are some, but it's very interesting. Most of the real hot-button issues were granted, if you call them that, they were granted before Scalia died, when there was a full court and when there was a clear 5-justice conservative majority on a bunch of issues. And now there isn't. And what they're doing is putting off the most controversial of those until later in the term, hoping against hope that maybe they'll have a ninth justice by then, and not scheduling them now when they would normally be scheduled early in the term because they were granted before Scalia died last February.
So the new justice, if and when we get one, will just be able to deal with cases that come up after that justice goes to the court.
That's correct, unless they schedule something that's already been argued for re-argument. They can do that in this term. They could schedule it for a re-argument next term. But unless there actually is a justice sitting there waiting to rehear a case or to hear a case for him or her for the first time, but for everybody else the second time, unless there's somebody there, there's no virtue in scheduling re-argument. And so they're sort of in limbo until they actually know they're going to get somebody.
So what are some of the cases that stand out to you this coming term?
Well, one of those cases that they've put off until later in the term is a case they granted in the middle of the last term. And it tests whether a state constitution or law can forbid direct or indirect aid to a parochial school. In this case, it's a church-run school in Missouri that wanted a grant for rubberized playgrounds using material from old tires. And it was denied a grant, even though it was certainly qualified for the grant and ranked high in qualifications for the grant. But clearly, it didn't get the grant because it's a religious school, religiously run school, even though the playground has nothing to do with religion. So the question, but that's definitely indirect aid to the school. And so people who would support such a denial would say money is fungible and the taxpayers shouldn't be supporting a religious school. And the religious school would say this is a grant that has nothing to do with religion. It only has to do with safety for kids. So that case really joins a tough issue, and it's not on the docket yet.
Any cases that are not being – that the judges have declined to hear this time around that you find significant?
Well, so far they denied – hearing any of the cases where they granted a stay, I guess you should say, didn't grant a stay to any of the election law cases that came up around this election. Now, that doesn't really mean anything except that whatever the lower court held, your voter ID law is unconstitutional. Your early voting cutback is constitutional in Ohio. Those decisions stay for this election. But you may recall that in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And in the immediate aftermath of that, state legislators in a lot of states with Republican-dominated legislatures enacted a bunch of laws to make it more difficult for people who are minority and poor to vote, cutting back on early voting, requiring having very strict ID requirements. And those, for the most part, have been struck down by the lower courts. And they will make their way back to the Supreme Court after this election. And the question is whether there's a majority to decide whether those laws should stay on the books or not.
Nina, what's going to happen with Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to replace Antonin Scalia on the bench? He hasn't gotten a vote yet. He hasn't had hearings yet. Will he?
Well, there's at least a chance for him to have a vote and a hearing in the lame duck session of Congress if Hillary Clinton wins and if Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, agrees that they can move forward on his nomination. Although McConnell so far has said he won't allow that it should wait until there's a new president, whether or not it's Trump or Clinton. And that means not until January, which would mean that if it's Garland, at the earliest he likely would be sitting on the court and hearing cases would be April. And if it's not Garland, it might not happen until the very end of the term. So we're likely in for another term without a ninth justice.
If it is Trump who gets to fill the seat, did it surprise you that he released a list of people that he might put on the court so early?
Well, nobody's ever done that before, that I know of anyway. But he's actually issued two lists, first a list of 11, then another list of 10. They're all very conservative, particularly socially conservative names. However, he's not committed in any way to naming somebody from those lists. That's just to give you an idea of what kind of person he wants to appoint.
Does it surprise you, just in the few seconds we have left, that the Supreme Court has not been a major issue in this presidential campaign?
It always surprises me because, and this time more than ever, because there's not a theoretical vacancy, there is a vacancy. And there's the possibility of as many as three more based on the fact that two of them are, two of the current justices are over 80 and one is 78. So the next president either could make a liberal, more liberal court, much more liberal court for a generation to come, or a dramatically more conservative court for decades and decades, many generations.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a big week for beer. Wednesday, the world's two biggest brewers, Anheuser-Busch InBev and SAB Miller, got shareholder approval to merge. The combined company will control almost a third of the global beer market. Meanwhile, the craft beer industry at the other end of the scale is also growing explosively, and one of the key ingredients for that craft beer has typically been grown in the Pacific Northwest, until now. Ariana Brocious of Here and Now contributor at Harvest Public Media reports from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Beer is made from four basic ingredients: water, malt, yeast, and hops.
Hops are perennial. They can last up to 35 years once planted.
Annette Wiles of Midwest Hop Producers shows off a plant at her two-year-old hop yard in Plattsmouth, Nebraska, close to the Iowa border. They've planted 23 different hop varieties on their three-acre test plot.
Our goal is to see what grows well in Nebraska, what's disease-resistant, drought-resistant, and pest-resistant.
Brewers use hops for bittering, aroma, and flavor. A century ago, New York and New England were home to the hop industry before succumbing to a dual threat, a fungus called downy mildew, and prohibition. Now, nearly all U.S. hops are grown in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. But as the craft beer craze has been sweeping the nation, farmers in other regions want in on the action.
However, our environment in these Midwest areas is totally different than where hops is typically grown.
That's University of Nebraska-Lincoln researcher Stacy Adams. He's also been testing which hop varieties will do best in Nebraska, using four test plots around the state with different microclimates and soil types.
Given our environment is somewhat volatile, we want to identify varieties that the farmer will be able to market, because the brewers are mainly looking for this consistency from year to year to year.
Universities throughout the Midwest and New England are also investing in research and training for this new specialty crop. Local farmers are starting to grow hop vines. That's bine with a B. But Mark Pattison says commercial hop growing can be daunting.
It costs anywhere from $10,000 to $12,000 to $15,000 per acre to put the plants and the trellises in the ground. And you don't get a mature crop for about 3 years. So you're not going to see any return on your investment for that 3 years. And hops are a very labor-intensive crop.
Pattison should know. He started Buck Creek Hops 3 years ago in south central Iowa. He's now the biggest grower in the state. Though the region's humidity can be a challenge, thanks to copious sunlight, Pattison says the Midwest is actually ripe for growing hops.
If you're between the 35th and 55th parallel in the U.S., you're in a good spot to grow hops. We're in the 46th.
Hop growing is taking off in many states, but Pattison is betting that Iowa has a good shot at competing on the hops market, since farming is at the state's core.
Now that we're looking for alternative crops in the Midwest, and with a shortage of hops, the craft brewing boom, we're seeing some of it come back.
And he says they can grow many of the same varieties as growers in the Pacific Northwest. The flavor of a Cascade hop, for example, pretty much remains the same.
A Cascade hop's a Cascade hop. Different soil types will produce different aromas and maybe sometimes a touch of different flavor. But in general, not a big difference.
Startup costs of industrial-scale equipment is a big reason why there aren't more large-scale hop farms in the Midwest. Midwest Hop Producers is investing millions of dollars to build the first commercial hops processing facility in Nebraska. They recently bought a huge harvester from Germany. They'll handle their own hops and those from other growers, too, a model others, like Pattison, are also adopting. The delicate hop cones, which are harvested at around 80% moisture, have to be handled right to maximize the qualities brewers want. Annette Wiles leads the way into their drying room, as hot and muggy as a sauna.
Similar to coffee beans, if you dry them too hot, too fast, you'll burn the oils and then you've ruined your crop.
Currently, most Midwest hop growers are small-scale hobbyists who sell wet hops, fresh off the vine, to breweries in the fall. But to supply breweries on a large scale year-round, hops have to be dried, milled, and turned into the pellet hops brewers prefer. Kim Kavalak, co-founder of Nebraska Brewing Company, is looking forward to a large-scale supply of local hops in the future.
We do see a future of that. We're really, really excited about that part of the industry growing.
And Kavalak says they'll partner on the brewing side as local hop producers continue to develop.
We'll do test batches and make sure that what they're using is either A, compatible with what we're already doing, or develop some other recipes that are compatible with the hops that they're growing.
So while most Nebraska beer is still made from hops from far away, a whole new kind of local craft beer may soon be on tap. For Here and Now, I'm Arianna Brocious in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, in a note, maybe with that craft beer, you'd like to have a nice pastrami on rye, or my personal favorite, tuna with tomato, hold the tuna. Well, we won't be able to do that much longer at New York's iconic Carnegie Deli. Employees were told this morning that the deli opened since 1937. Jeremy, it's going to close at the end of this year.
However, it will be open in other cities, or they're going to continue licensing the brand in other cities and selling products wholesale, but no more Carnegie Deli on 55th Street.
I have to buy up
anymore.
Their black and white cookies.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.